Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we're going to start. A piece of housekeeping. The class is set to end on July 5th, but it turns out the last Monday night, I've been told, will be July 28th, so that's after tonight, 2 more weeks. I have a lot to do today, but before we get, and I want to answer Bill Gewirtz's question from last week. Before we get to that, just a couple things that you might find interesting that I saw. We spoke, and if you recall, within Rav Unterman, the Rav Unterman classes, this is going back a couple of years, about the status of swordfish. So let me call your attention to something interesting. Ari Zivotofsky, some of you might know him, he's very involved in researching traditions, the traditions that have been lost, things like that. And for the last couple of years, they put on what they call a Masora dinner. That is a dinner in which they serve all sorts of food, pheasant and other things, which are not commonly eaten because you need a Masora, a tradition to eat them. And he and his friend have tracked down many of these lost Masoras. And if you establish that these food items were eaten, especially we're talking about birds in particular, because we know 150 years ago, there was about 25, 30 different birds that could be eaten because we have a book that has pictures of all of them. Today, how many does the OU certify? 5 or 6? But at this next dinner, which they're having in a couple weeks, and they sent out the publicity already. I don't know if I still have the publicity, but it's easy to get. They describe what they're going to be having. In previous years, they've had grasshoppers and other things. This year, they're actually serving swordfish. So I wrote to him because I was a little bit surprised. I thought that other than the Rabbanut in Eilat, I thought that all the rabbinates in Israel rejected swordfish or weren't approving swordfish. And he tells me that no. That, first of all, there's another rabbinate, he says, in the works that's going to be certifying swordfish. Some big rabbis, including Rav Machpud, who's a big Yemenite Rav with a Hechsher there, permits swordfish. And he also says the national rabbinate, that's the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel, recognizes the Eilat's rabbinate's decision in this matter, which means that the chief rabbinate of Israel accepts swordfish as kosher, although until now none of the hotels throughout Israel serve swordfish. They did in the 1960s. In the 1960s, as we spoke about, the chief rabbinate did recognize it, and now they're going to be recognizing it again. And this is a big deal because this event, they have rabbis and scholars from all over the country. Rav Tendler has been to at least one, if not two, of the events, and therefore it has national publicity. The chief rabbin of Israel has signed off on serving swordfish. So this is just one of the numerous examples I like to cite that traditional Judaism doesn't stand still. In fact, we will be seeing more about swordfish today. 2 minutes. Because we dealt with Eliezer Berkovitz in a few classes, I just wanted to call your attention to something I picked up when I was in Israel a week and a half ago, a new book by Rav Aviner, who wrote Me'ofel, a book on the Holocaust. So it's hard to keep track of Aviner's books. He comes out with about 10 a year. But in this book, which just came out last year on page 37, remember what Eliezer Berkovitz's whole point was, that the Holocaust, it's not God's doing, it's people speak in terms of, in fact, he sees it as blasphemous to speak about God wanting a Holocaust or anything like this. Aviner really has the traditionalist perspective. He says, where was God during the Holocaust? We answer, we do not know. But this we know and we are certain. He was... He was there. Hashem did all of this. Ki Hashem asa kol ela. Hakol hu asa. He did all everything. Hu asa at HaShoah. He did the Holocaust. He's responsible for it. Sheba ne'arag shlish amenu. Hu asa at HaTzalah. He goes on and on. That we believe, basically Jewish faith, that God is responsible for the Holocaust for reasons we can't understand, but he killed, or he's responsible for the deaths, fundamentally the deaths of all the people in the Holocaust. Obviously, that doesn't mean the Nazis are off the hook. But that's revolving Aviner's point. And my last thing I want to call your attention to before I turn to Chaim Ozer Rosinsky and answer the question that we finished last week, was a new Sefer. A new book came out just about 2 weeks ago, or Yitzhak, Rav Yitzhak Abadi, Volume 2. And as you'd expect with him, it's full of interesting stuff in it. I have a Sfarim blog post, which is supposed to go up at the end of the week. It was actually supposed to go up today. However, New York Times today is carrying a story, or tomorrow actually, on the website now, is carrying a story on the Heilman book, the Heilman and Friedman book, about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So they wanted to post now, today, Chaim Rappaport's 45-page essay on this book, Biography of Lubavitcher Rebbe. But I'm gonna refer to this book because he has some interesting stuff against asceticism. Part of my post is going to deal with particularly sexual asceticism. He doesn't like that, but he has something which is relevant to what we've been speaking about, which he quotes from Rav Aaron Cutler. As I said, there's lots of interesting stuff. Just if any of you get the Sefer, on page 116, Zorach Chaim, Siman Kuf Samech Vav, he talks about if you forget to leave the people who don't turn the light off in the refrigerator all the time, they turn it off, let's say, Erev Shabbos. If you forget to turn it off Erev Shabbos, what can you do with the refrigerator? And he sees no problem whatsoever. You can open the refrigerator, close the refrigerator, it's a Psik Reisha Dor Nichole, it's a Durabanan with the electricity here, it's Kol Achar Yad. So in half a page, he just disposes of this without any problem. It's going to go on if you forgot to turn off the light. Vadai she'en kiboy zeh asur min ha-Torah. But what I want to mention is on page 217, he tells a story, which is told in other places too, and he quotes Baron Cutler, about how we began our talks on Rav Chaim Ozer Grozinski by mentioning that Rav Chaim Ozer Grozinski, who was the unofficial Rav of Vilna, because there wasn't a rabbi in Vilna since the days of Rav Shmuel, days of the Vilna Gaon. And there's a story, a famous story told about how there was once a machlokas about a woman who, with a chicken or something else between the Vilna Gaon and Rav Shmuel, that if she brought it to both of them, and Rav Shmuel was matir and the Vilna Gaon forbid it. And the story, as it's told, says that Rav Shmuel demanded that the Vilna Gaon come with him and eat at this woman's house. I can't imagine, and this is a true story, because I mean, you just can't imagine what the Vilna Gaon in someone's house. But the story is told, and the upshot of the story is that however great the Vilna Gaon was, Rav Shmuel was the Rav and the Av Beis Din. Therefore, the Vilna Gaon went along with it, because even though the Vilna Gaon held differently, the Rav of the city had paskened that the food was kosher, and the Vilna Gaon was ready to eat. But the story is, the sof maaseh, the end of the story is that when they brought the, actually it was soup with not the chicken, that was a question about, the candle, which was made of fat, non-kosher fat, fell into the soup. And then he quotes Ravar, so therefore they couldn't eat it, and he quotes Ravar and Cutler as saying that this is well known in Lithuania, obviously, the story, that the Min HaShamayim, they looked out for the kavod of the Vilna Gaon to make sure he wouldn't have to eat something that he paskened was not kosher. But Ravar and Cutler concludes, of a Min HaDin, Vadai Shahaya Mutar. But according to the Halacha, certainly this was permitted, because as Yav Beis and Rav Shmuel had ruled that it was permitted. Now, let's begin now with Rav Chaim Ozer Rosinsky and answer the question that we left off with last time that Bill raised. The term Beit HaRoshet, rabbinic factory, that Rav Chaim Ozer uses about the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. Incidentally, as I said, people in the Rabbinical Seminary themselves always stress that it's not a rabbinical factory, because this was the view of some people. So Bill said, well, is it true, or he raised the question because he heard from Sharon Lyman, is it true that Rav Chaim Ozer in his letter, Mayor Hildesheimer, actually used this expression? We don't have any other letters, incidentally, which he uses this expression. We have the letter, the published letter, addressed to Mayor Hildesheimer, which he uses this expression. Now, the first time that a question was raised about this was in this book, Torah Im Derech Eretz, where someone quotes Mayor Hildesheimer, that's Israel Hildesheimer's grandson, as saying that in the original letter, this term doesn't appear. And truth of the matter is, that's incorrect. First of all, Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg, although Mayor Hildesheimer does not use the term when he is debating with Chaim Moshe Grzynski, Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg says that you've referred to our institution as a rabbinical factory. Clearly, he's getting it from the letter to Mayor Hildesheimer. I find it hard to believe that he's getting it from another letter. But more important than that, Daniel Schwartz, who's a scholar in Israel, who wrote about this very event, he corresponded with Mayor Hildesheimer, and it turns out that the letter that Mayor Hildesheimer was telling everyone that Beit HaRosh al Rabbanim does not appear in, that's a different letter, a letter written later by Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski, where it's also included in the collected letters that he doesn't mention call it a rabbinical factory. He just, again, criticizes the rabbinical seminary, says that they don't need this in the land of Israel. But the letter that Mayor Hildesheimer is talking about is not the same letter. The letter that's included in the book is a prior letter from a few months. So obviously there's no no reason to assume otherwise. We have a letter published like the letters of Chaim Moshe Grzynski in which you're factory. Being that Mayor Hildesheimer was the one who said that it didn't appear in the original letter, and it turns out that he's referring to a different letter back with the original letter, that, yes, he calls it a rabbinical factory. I ended last class by saying that Rav Chaim Ozer was the most significant posek in his day, but in terms of posterity, a couple of responsa that have remained significant, and let's talk about them briefly. The first one deals with conversion. This has been in the news a lot in the last few years. He was confronted, as Rav Chaim Ozer was confronted by an issue that's all over the news today, that of people converting who are still going to violate halacha, not going to become immediately pious. This is an issue those who've been with us for a couple of semesters know I have great interest in, and I'm going to be coming out with an article, a fairly long article, in the next couple of months in which I deal with this very issue. But Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski's position is as follows. He distinguishes between violations, let's say, avon, that is, people who violate it, they accept the halacha, they accept Jewish law, but they're weak, or they don't feel that they want to adapt their lifestyle completely to an Orthodox lifestyle, but in theory, they accept the Torah, they know it's the right way to live. After all, don't all converts violate some laws? They all speak Lashon Hara, they do other things, so it's just a question of degree. So those people who convert, with the intention, knowing that they're going to violate halacha, it's not an invalid conversion. As long as they accept the Torah, they accept the halacha, just they recognize they're weak. This viewpoint of his was criticized by the Kovno Rav, but it makes a lot of sense. There's numerous sources that can be brought to support this. On the other hand, those who convert, and ab initio, they have this notion that we do not accept this law. That is, they convert and they say, well, I like Shabbos and Kashrus, but I don't want to like Pesach. That doesn't make any sense to me. That is, if in theory, as a matter of principle, you reject the binding authority of a certain law, or you say that I don't accept any law, it doesn't matter. And that's what the Talmud means when it says someone who converts without accepting all the Torah, it's not a valid conversion. It doesn't mean in practice. It means in theory that they don't accept that this is a essential Torah, but someone who converts and knows that this is the law but just won't live up to it, that's fine. He goes further, though. And he says, however, that one who wants to become Jewish, but also it's clear to us, either he tells us or it's 100% clear to us, that he will not observe Shabbos and Kashrus, that is not a valid conversion. So Rav Chaim Ozer makes a distinction, and he doesn't say Taras and Mishpacha. Those are the two he says, Shabbos and Kashrus, we cannot accept this one, and not only can't we accept him, it's not a valid conversion. And we're not talking about someone who's out of town, let's say, and there's no restaurants, and he decides to go into some fish restaurant, or even, I guess, eat meat, because he's hungry. We're talking about someone who, as a general rule, is going to live his life not observing Shabbos or not observing Kashrus, even if he says that he understands that this is the halacha, you have to keep Shabbos, and he thinks it's a good thing, but he just chooses himself not to, Chaim Ozer says that that is not a valid conversion. It's a sign for him that these two are regarded as so big and so important that if someone is going to live their life from the moment they convert without observing them, that's a sign that he never accepted Judaism in the first place. If he converts and he's a regular, typical, normal Jew, and then later he starts eating non-kosher, that of course he's still a Jew. But someone who converts, and from the day he converts, he's not careful about davening mincha, it's still a valid conversion. However, if you convert, and immediately you don't have a kosher home, or you have no interest, and there's never been any expectation of you, even tell the dayanim, that you don't intend to keep kosher, that is not a valid conversion, or don't accept Shabbos. I'm going to get back to this in a minute. Now, Rav Chaim Ozer does say, however, that Batei Din should not convert people. We're not going to be observant. That is, I'm not talking about people who will not be careful in every area, but someone, well, even though they're going to be kosher and Shabbos observant, is going to violate other things. We can think of all sorts of things people violate. He says that a Beis Din should not convert such a person, although if they do convert them, it's a valid Beis Din. And he also says that we, that is us who are more stringent in this area, should not protest against those Batei Din who do convert people, even though they're not going to be very observant. This is very similar, by the way, to Rav Moshe Feinstein. One of his chulas on conversions, in which he's actually stringent in the sense that he says that the convert has to accept, basically accept all mitzvos. He also says, however, he's ma'am mitzvos, he says he knows that there are many rabbis who do convert people, and they don't really follow all the mitzvos. And he says that presumably they rely on the fact that these people who are converting think that these mitzvos are just a chumrah. It's not a real mitzvah, it's not an obligation, because they look around and they see all sorts of people not being observant. And therefore, although Rav Moshe himself doesn't like this, he says this is presumably the reason, the justification why Orthodox Rabbanim are converting people knowing that they're not going to be observant. Yeah, he becomes more, as time goes on, he becomes more liberal. I think that tshuva, which I just mentioned, is addressed to a rabbi in Canton, Ohio. But Rav Chaim Ozer gives an amazing reason as to why we shouldn't protest those Batei Din that are converting people, even though they're not going to be 100% observant. So this is in volume 3, number 21. He says, and I'll read you in Hebrew and then translate it, Ein ani motzeh l'nachon sheyer ishu al zeh. Rabbanei Hador, we shouldn't protest about the Batei Din who are converting people who are not so observant. Why not? He says that the masses are going to see this as a chilash. Have these men who want to convert. They're going to be fairly observant, that is, they commit to being shown Shabbos and Kashrus. And when I say Shabbos, I don't think we're talking about little things. I think we're talking about major things. They're not going to publicly violate Shabbos if they carry a handkerchief. I don't think that is what he's referring to. So although Rav Chaim Ozer says, unless we know they're going to be completely observant, we shouldn't convert them. If other Batei Din do it, we shouldn't protest. Because the masses, that is, the Jewish masses, are say it's a chil Hashem. Here you have someone who's married to a non-Jewish woman. He wants to convert her, and the rabbis refuse to permit it. It's going to make Judaism look dead in the eyes of the masses. And Rav Chaim Ozer says that's a reason to allow these rabbis to continue converting, and especially with regard to the children, because if the children grow up in a non-Orthodox environment, the standard position until very recently was it's no big deal. Rav Moshe Feinstein says this explicitly. This is Michael Broyd's plan to solve the conversion problem in Israel. Just convert all the children of the Russians. So when they go to the army, they'll all be Jewish. You won't have intermarriage. And the fact that they're growing up in non-observant homes, or even with one parent who's not Jewish, it doesn't matter, because Rav Moshe Feinstein holds, and many others, or Chaim Ozer, you see, it held that it's better to grow up Jewish, even in a non-Orthodox environment, than to grow up not Jewish. Some rabbis thought differently. They thought that this is putting a stumbling block, because a non-Jew is not obligated in mitzvos. And therefore, if you convert someone who's going to grow up and not be observant, he's going to violate all these laws, it's better that he not be Jewish. But most people think otherwise, because first of all, the person doesn't know any better. He's a tinuk shenishka as it is. So it's better to be a Jew and have the spark of Judaism in you and be able to return to Judaism. And especially when a parent, we don't just go out and convert people stam on the street, but if there's a parent who wants the child to be Jewish, that's better than having the child is not Jewish. And that would solve all the problems in the state of Israel. Yeah, that's a good point. By the way, how to interpret Chaim Oser is not so clear, because very relatively recently this book appeared. Two volumes, Zera Yisrael, by Rav Chaim Amsalem, member of the Knesset, Shas Party. Now, he has been making waves for about a year now, and it culminated a few weeks ago where Yated Ne'aman published the Chayrim against him, signed by the Haredi Gedolim. It was coming. There's no question it was coming. He began by speaking about conversion, his book, arguing for a liberal approach to conversion, which in a sense was the approach that Rav Chaim Oser's approach was the standard approach for Batei Din, even in the state of Israel for many years. That is, you convert people even though they're not going to be so observant. We all know people converted and are not very observant. That was, as I said, the standard approach, and it certainly was an approach with many, many rabbanim. He has a whole volume. The second volume is the tshuvot of all these great rabbis who explain precisely why it's okay to convert people even though they're not going to be so observant. Rav Uziel is famous for that. We've spoken about him. Classes are Rav Uziel, but many, many more. W.T. Hoffman, Rav Unterman, and the list goes on and on. So that's how he created his first controversy, and he believes you convert all these Russians. They want to be Jewish. They want to be halachic. They want to be traditional. He has a letter of approbation in this book by Rav Nachum Rabinovitz of Maariv Dumim, by Rav Meir Mazuz, who's the most important Sephardic Rosh Hashiva in Israel, who states explicitly that it's enough to want to be a traditional Jew. That is, you don't convert someone who's going to live on a atheist kibbutz, but someone who wants to be traditional but not completely observant. We all know what the word Masorati means. That's okay. Rav Duchovsky, who was a dayan in the Beis Din HaGadol, Rav Zalman Chenya Goldberg has haskama, Rav Dov Lior, Rav Kiryat Arba, Rav Shar Yashav Cohen. So great rabbis give haskama, but the condemnation of the book says it's heresy, this book, it's terrible, all these things. That was we can expect from the Haredi. I wonder if any of them even saw the book. But that wasn't the only thing that got him in trouble. Then he came out with a little booklet in favor of moving the graves in Ashkelon that the Haredim are still protesting about. When I say the Haredim, that's really not true. It's the Haredi types. They're protesting. And then he came out just a few weeks ago against Kollel, saying that this is just for limited people, that in the Sephardic world, it's a terrible thing that they're now following the Ashkenazim, this idea that there's something wrong with working. In my next post, that's going to be on the Sarenbog, I'll give the link to his interview, where he explains that this is not our approach, this is a terrible thing that the Ashkenazim have now enticed Sephardim into this idea that there's something wrong with working. So basically, he's been throwing up the gauntlet to the Ashkenazi Haredi world for a while. In this book, on page 239, I don't know if he's correct, but he interprets Rav Chaim Oser in a more liberal fashion than he's ever been interpreted. He says that even if the person who converts does not observe Shabbos, that's not enough of a reason to say it's not a valid conversion. Rather, there has to also be a desire on the part of the person, and no desire on the part of the person to convert. That is, he interprets Rav Chaim Oser as saying that a conversion which is invalid is a conversion which is completely phony, which is just for show to get married. And a sign of that is the lack of observance of Shabbos. However, if you have a situation where it's clear that a person does want to be Jewish, for example, they observe other mitzvos, or we have other ways of determining it, the fact that they don't observe Shabbos is not enough of a reason to say it's an invalid conversion. And he's medayeg. He sees this in the language of Rav Chaim Oser, because when Rav Chaim Oser discusses this, he seems to give two qualifications: lack of observance of Shabbos and the fact that you're not serious about your inner is not the same as your outer. That is, you're trying to fool the Beis Din. I just call that to your attention. And as I said, this position of Rav Chaim Oser was pretty standard for a long time, and it's direct opposition to the current Haredi position. current Haredi position is that if you're not observant, it's an invalid conversion. And the Chaim Moser distinguished between the reason why you're not observant. If you're not observant, you accept the Torah, but you want to live somewhat of a traditional lifestyle, but it's not for you. It's too hard. But you know this is the right way to live. And you could show this in many ways. We all know people who send their kids to day school, even though they're not so observant, to Orthodox day schools. They're the non-observant Orthodox. They think it's the proper lifestyle. Many of them are real believers, even. They it's too hard for them, or their lives are complicated. We all know cases like this. Chaim Moser says that these people are, as long as they observe Shabbos and Kashrus, that it's okay. The second issue that Rav Chaim Moser is for is permitting gelatin. We discussed gelatin a good number of times because this is another one of the examples that I see how we don't yet have. There are certain ideas I've mentioned a number of times where, although poskim in the past have differed with it, certain consensus has developed. For example, this semester, we spoke about an umbrella on Shabbos. And I told you that the Chasam Sofer, which isn't too long ago, early 19th century, he ruled that you could use an umbrella on Shabbos. Certainly, if it's open, you could use it. In Pressburg, people used it. But subsequent to him, very few people agreed with him. And it's become unacceptable. I don't even think that if you use an umbrella on Shabbos today, even if there's an Erev and Shabbos, I don't think they would count you as at a wedding. It's become so accepted, despite the fact that the Chasam Sofer, who's greater than the Chasam Sofer in the last 200 years? So a consensus has developed. Gelatin, a consensus has not developed. First of all, in the land of Israel, they have different types of kashrus. And when I was in America, you can't get so-called reliable glot meat, non-glot kosher meat. In Israel, it's all over non-glot. Another thing is, in Israel, gelatin has always been accepted by the chief rabbinate. Goes back to a response on Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and then Rav Vad Yosef permits all gelatin. But the first one, and when I say it's that we haven't reached consensus is because if another great posek arises in America, he could have a different opinion, and he could say yes, gelatin, and the situation in Israel could change. It goes back and forth on this issue. Now, I don't know if they were using gelatin in Europe or how common it was in Rav Chaim Moser's time. And one of his responsa, find it here, he says that they weren't using gelatin. There was this assumption, let me find the exact words here. Yeah, there was, before Rav Chaim Moser's time, there was an assumption that gelatin was not kosher. And people hadn't really investigated it. There are three responses. Why should I assume it's not kosher? Because it comes from non-kosher animals, even from pigs, both bones and skin. I haven't seen that. It depends which hechsher you're talking about. The chief, for example, for all these years, used to have the marshmallows from Israel that just had Rabbi Grossman from Migdal Emek. His hechsher didn't say that. It simply said on the package, kosher gelatin, which means those people who think gelatin is kosher. It could be now they put it in there, and I don't know if that's for Israel or for Chutz La'aretz, but I have definitely seen packages from Israel where they don't say that at all. And there's different hashkachas, by the way. There's the Rabbanut, there's Rabbi Yosef's hashkacha, so I don't know. We did have hashkacha in America that did say that. The late Rabbi Sharfman's hashkacha, the Half Moon K, for a while, they were putting it out where it said kosher for those who eat gelatin. But that was never the case for all the years that I lived, that I was in Israel, and I saw these things. The chief rabbin of Jerusalem, the chief rabbin of Israel, just gave answer to it. Now, Rav Chaim Moser has three responsa on gelatin. Two of them are mistaken. Two of them are in, I believe, in the Achiezer. One of them was published from a manuscript in this book, by David Sheinkopf's Issue in Jewish Dietary Laws, which is going to be reprinted very soon. And I mentioned he takes issue with Rav Yosef. He only thinks the gelatin is permitted if it comes from cows, not even non-kosher cows, but not pig. He gives the hechsher to Dan and Yogurt. You see, some Dan and Yogurt has an OU, other Dan and Yogurt has a K. And it says on the package, kosher gelatin. Again, that's not kosher. It's just, he holds the gelatin as kosher. He also gives the hashgacha to Joiva. If you look on the marshmallows, they're the ones that say in the package that they have corn syrup, and this is based on Rita Ochanan's Spector's decision. That's the book in which he describes both of them. Rav Chaim Ozer, his three responses were to the following people. One was to Rabbi Konvitz. Rabbi Konvitz, leading rabbi in Newark, the son-in-law of the Ritbaz, the father of Milton Konvitz, the professor. The other was to Rav Shmuel Aaron Pardes, who's the editor of the journal HaPardes. And the other is, that one is printed, published by manuscript in here. And the other is, it doesn't say who it's to. Now, these rabbis had permitted it. There were big rabbis in America who permitted it, including these rabbis, Konvitz and Pardes. You also had Rabbi Baskin, Rabbi Winograd, Rabbi Seltzer, Rabbi Henkin. They all permitted gelatin. But they wanted, not all of them permitted from pig, by the way. Henkin didn't. But they permitted gelatin from cows. And they wanted the Gadol Hador too. Now, prior to the gelatin issue, rabbis had discussed something else known as junket, which was a dessert that contained rennet, stomach lining of a calf. Now, the issues here were very similar to gelatin, and Rabbi Graubert from Toronto, the Chaval in Benin, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Cyrilson, we mentioned him, the great Rav of Kishinev, they had given their permission, and here, let me show you an example of the ad for it, that appeared in the Hapardes. Hapardes was the journal of the European Rabbanim in America, the Rabbanim, and this ad would appear constantly for junket rennet powder. It goes back, see this in the 40s, in the 50s. There's junket. By the way, I'll show you some other ads here. You have an ad for kosher gelatin from these rabbis also that appeared. And remember, this is the journal. This is not the modern Orthodox newspaper. This is what today we would call the Haredi or the Yeshivish journal. Kojo. But Kojo, unlike today's Kojo, where they made a Kojo which was from actually kosher gelatin that is produced by Orthodox Jews from kosher animals, this Kojo was just... it was just gelatin. And they call it kosher gelatin dessert because there's a hashgacha on it to make sure it's produced in a proper fashion, but the animals are not kosher or anything. They're just making sure that the gelatin is of a sort that what makes gelatin kosher? Well, if there's no taste to it. It's ifso meachila, that is, it can't be eaten anymore. It only serves a function in the production of the food. So here you have this ad that would appear also all the time. We've spoken a lot about kosher, so let's just let me tell you a bit about how kosher things worked in America before we get to Rafai Moser's ruling on this. And I see we have, coincidentally or maybe not, the grandson of a person I'll speak about right now. I just want to give you an example of how things worked. Well, first of all, we know that most of the time they relied on ingredients. But not always. The Agudas Rabbanim, also in Hapardes, published lists. So, for example, here's a list of food that was kosher. It says Heinz has OU, but then these other products don't have OUs or anything like that. Different rabbis gave hashkachas, and they would have these... they would put together these lists, which is just like what happens in Europe today. The Agudas Rabbanim would put together a list of those products and restaurants. This is from the 1940s. Of the various products that the Agudas Rabbanim says is kosher, you see here Kellogg's. Like a long time. Now Kellogg's has a K, but under the VOD, the VH of Austin. By the way, often you find people tell you that when you see a K on hashgacha on a product, you can't rely on it because it could just be the it's not a trademark symbol, and the company could just put it on. Obviously, you should find out who's the K on, and you can call call the company, they'll tell you. But I, in all the years, and I always check this, never once have I ever found a product that has a K without a rabbi behind it. No company would, has ever put a K on it. But before Rabbi, before the Vod of Boston, BH was giving your hechsher to Kellogg's, it was actually this rabbi, who I believe is the last person who commented, Yaakov. This is his grandfather, Yaakov Eskolsky. He put the hechsher on Kellogg's. He actually was in a battle with Agudas Rabbanim because the Agudas Rabbanim proclaimed that, this goes back already to the 1920s, that it's forbidden to give hashgacha on a meat plant that also was producing non-kosher meat. That is, you had these slaughterhouses that they were shechting non-kosher and also shechting kosher, and they just had separate areas. And that could create a real problem because, you know, you shech the meat, you don't know if this is the kosher or non-kosher. Even if they closed it off, they said nope. They made a takana, which was reaffirmed every 10 years or so, including the days of Ramosha Feinstein, that it's forbidden to give a hashkacha to a plant that produces kosher or non-kosher. The Star K actually broke with this takana about, if you remember, Zalman's meat. But there was another group of rabbis, not the Agudas Rabbanim. They called themselves another name, and Rabbi Eskolsky was in it, and they believed and they continued to give hashkacha to these plants that had kosher and non-kosher. They were actually thrown out of the Agudas Rabbanim. Meat production was parnassa for these rabbis, so it was important. Now, after he was no longer on the scene, his son was a rabbi also, and YU Musmach, Michael Eskolsky. He gave the hashkacha. Here's a picture of Mitchell or Michal. Rabbi Mitchell Eskolsky reports on his trip to the Kellogg Company. Once a year, he would go to, it says his annual event. Once a year, he would go to the Kellogg's factory to make sure everything was being run properly. So even here we see, it's not hashkacha that we have today. Today, the OU tells us that they can make spot checks. They always come in. The person doesn't, so the factory doesn't know. They have access to all the records. In these days, in the 1940s, you know, once a year he would go and he would check to make sure that things were running properly. There was an assumption that if the company tells you this is what's in it, they're not going to lie. And that's how hashkacha works all over the world to this day. That's how it works in England. Not in America, though, as we spoke with Rav Henkin. Let me show you some other interesting things about this. Here's an example of something we would never find today, also from Hapardes. Peanut oil. Kosher for Pesach. And now let me show you about fish. How do you know what fish are kosher? In those days, you didn't have kosher fish stores. So you went to the regular market, and you need to know. So what they did is they put out lists of kosher fish. Here's one of the lists. You need to put the scientific name. That's important because often there's different names for fish. But look over here. Ah, someone's making it bigger. But get my pointer. Here we have swordfish. So we see that in the 1930s in America, Jews ate swordfish. Orthodox Jews and the leading rabbis in America. Ones who were behind Yeshivas Rabbi Tzvi Yochanan, the great East European Rabbani, they're telling us that swordfish is kosher. And look a bit above. Right here. Sturgeon. They're saying that sturgeon's kosher. So now we know sturgeon is an old dispute. By the way, if you're interested in the swordfish dispute, Ari Zivotofsky has a nice long article in which he deals with it. To this day, by the way, in Rome, you can buy swordfish in the market under hashkacha. So he discusses all the traditions. But sturgeon was a dispute in Prague, because in Prague they ate sturgeon. They admitted it. But then it was pretty much forbidden throughout the rest of Europe, or most of Europe. But here we see that in America, the Rabbanim permitted sturgeon. I'll show you an example of an ad. So after the Agudas Rabbanim permitted it, this ad appeared in a Pardes for a number of issues. Here's at least. So it tells you how delicious sturgeon is. But it says the sturgeon fish is found in the list from the Agudas Rabbanim as a kosher fish. Another example of how our eating habits and what is regarded as acceptable has really changed in a few generations. Okay, let us return then to Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's responsum. What's the issue with all these things? Rennet, gelatin, carmine. Carmine comes from a, is this food coloring. It's like the red food coloring. It comes from a beetle. Crush it. And Rav Avadya Yosef permits it, as do others, because what's the issue? Question is, can a product be used if its form is completely changed and if it's now inedible? When I say inedible, I don't mean can you eat it. Obviously, you can eat it. I can take a piece of cardboard and I can eat the cardboard also. But that's not what it means, edible. Edible means if it has a taste and you eat it for the taste. Toothpaste also, but it's not regarded as edible. It's not food. That's what it means. So is it... Now, some people think that even if it's not edible, color of Shai Yosef Cohen thinks of it as color. That's significant. And so yeah, when I don't want to go into all the debates back and forth. Let me just say that Rav Chaim Ozer's position was that gelatin is permissible. I believe this is very ironic because, as I mentioned last class, Louis Ginsberg at the JTF, he was asked also, at the very same time, a little bit later, 1949, is gelatin kosher? And you can find his answer in the response of Louis Ginsberg, edited by David Galinkin, and on page 153, this is what Louis Ginsberg says. I fully agree with you. He's writing to someone who wrote to him and thought that despite what the Orthodox rabbis were saying, Rabbi Pardes and Rav Chaim Ozer, he thought that gelatin should be forbidden. Might be the only case where the conservatives want to be more machmir than the Orthodox. But Ginsberg writes, it is needless to say that I fully agree with you that there is no basis whatsoever for declaring gelatin kosher. But I doubt whether your very lucid explanation of the chemical processes will change the opinion of the two rabbis, that is, Rabbi Pardes and Rabbi Chaim Ozer. Being an optimist by nature, I am inclined to assume that the position taken by the two rabbis on this matter is due exclusively to their ignorance of natural science. A less optimistic nature might explain their action in a different way, but I don't think it is worth discussing. Actually, he's not referring here to, when he speaks about these two rabbis, he's referring to Konvitz and, not referring to Chaim Ozer, he's referring to Konvitz and Pardes. He speaks about Chaim Ozer in the next paragraph. The less optimistic nature explaining their action a different way would be about money. They wanted the hashkacha on the junket, on the kojel, or things like that. So therefore, he's saying, if you're not an optimist, you assume that they're going to declare it kosher just to get the contract. But he's saying he's an optimist. So he thinks that they believe it's really kosher, but they're ignorant. And then he goes on, by the way, it is a sheer coincidence that those two rabbis, that is, Konvitz and Pardes, have based their opinion on two authorities to whom I happen to be related. In my first letter to you, I mentioned the fact that Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grudzinski was the husband of a cousin of mine. And I may add today that I am a direct descendant of Rabbi Moses Zisserlis, the greatest authority for Ashkenazic Jewry. Yet with all due respect to this great man, now he's referring to the Ramah, not Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, I agree with you that he never would have expressed his view of dried stomach if he had lived today when the knowledge of chemistry is so much more advanced than that known to chemists of his day. So, I'll explain to you what he's talking about in a minute about the stomach business. But here you have Louis Ginsberg saying that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, the only way that he could permit gelatin, the only way the Ramah could permit a different issue, which I'll mention right now, is that they were unaware of basic chemistry. I don't know of any other example where the conservative movement in ritual matters is more machmir than the Orthodox. When it comes to social matters, they say they're machmir all the time. They're machmir on civil and social justice and all these things, but on ritual matter. Subsequent to Ginsberg, however, his Talmud Muvhak, Isaac Klein, permitted gelatin, and the conservative movement has been permitting gelatin now for many, many years. Isaac Klein was one of only three people given personal smicha. Ginsburg. He's a musmach of YU, Isaac Klein, started with the Mechiter, then he got smicha from Ginsburg. Other than him, the only others to get the smicha were Finkelstein and Boaz Cohen. But if anyone else knows of examples where the conservative movement expressed himself more stringently than the Orthodox, let me know. So what's this business, though, that he says that the Ramah, who speaks about the stomach, never would have given his heter had he been aware of basic chemistry? Well, this is in Yoredeya, 87, Zion. See what number 10, 87:10, and this is, I'll read it in Hebrew and then translate it. He says, "Or hakeba, lifamim mochimoto umiyavshinoto, benasek eitz umalimoto chalav mutar demachar shenityavesh havek eitz ba'ama ve'embo achuchi pasar," which means the skin of the stomach. Talking about either properly slaughtered animals or even improperly slaughtered animals, is sometimes salted and dried, and then becomes like wood. So the stomach itself has no more juice, as it were. Then it is filled with milk to make cheese. This is permissible because after the skin becomes dry, it's a mere wood without any meat mix. So even though you're putting the milk inside the stomach of the animal, it's no different than putting it in like a plastic container. There's no meat residue. There's nothing, the meat will never come off it, so it's no different than any other item you're putting it in. Now, the dried stomach is used to make the rennet used in cheese. Now, Ginsburg doesn't really explain why Rav Chaim Moser is wrong on this, why the Rama is wrong on this. The other person who he corresponded with, he just says, from my knowledge of chemistry and its manufacturer, he says that it doesn't matter, even if the bones have been cleaned, the gelatin is treif. And as to rennet, he says that points out his error, right, part of his error, but he doesn't actually know about, he confuses junket with gelatin, he points out his errors, but he never replied to him. Basically, they never explain here what the problem is. But there's a problem, according to them. But according to the Ramah, that's how you make the rennet used in cheese. It's not a problem because there's no real meat residue. Shlomo says if you need a get from a conservative marriage. Ah, brilliant. Shlomo's correct. Obviously, the conservative movement rules that you need a get from a conservative marriage. And at least the di'avad, ex post facto, great poskim have said that conservative marriage, if you can show that the witnesses were not appropriate, don't need a get, and if you can't even determine that in an emergency situation, you can assume that it's not, if you don't know any better, you can assume it's an invalid marriage. Obviously, the conservative movement holds that marriages need a get, so very good. What were some of his other interesting responsa? In volume 3, number 24, he permits the use of a condom if it's dangerous for the woman to become pregnant. And that's what I said last week, that I was somewhere where the rabbi, not in my town, but the rabbi stated as a matter of course, as we say, a muskal risho, something obvious, that since condoms are absolutely forbidden under no circumstances, he was talking about birth control, and he says under no circumstance could a condom ever be permitted. It's a terrible sin, going through all these things. And I was thinking while I was sitting there, as I mentioned last week, that this is very interesting because Rav Chaim Moser, he was a pretty learned rabbi, and he didn't come to this decision that this rabbi said. And as I mentioned, I wasn't sure whether I should point this out. My assumption was to point it out privately, not publicly. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually agrees with Rav Chaim Moser on this. Because, yes, when it comes to birth control, condom is the least permissible. The other options are much more permissible, be it a pill, a diaphragm, all these other options. But if the only method available, in those days they didn't have the pill, was the condom, what are you going to say? That the husband has to get divorced? Never have relations with his wife? As Rav Chaim Moser points out, no, we don't go that far. And that although you have all sorts of discussions about spilling seed and everything, there's other things that outweigh that. And I saw that Rachel Yahu, this volume, They're now publishing his responsa of his years as chief rabbi. I intend to have classes on Mordechai Eliyahu, but in his responsa from 1988 to 1989, on page 537, this is right at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. He was asked about a man who has AIDS and if he could use a condom with his wife. I don't know today. I think today they might say get divorced. But that was the question. And he answers that rabbis only permit him to have sex with his wife only if he has a condom without any hole. He says, nearly, sheyesh l'hatir b'nido n'zeh. My opinion, you can permit in this situation. And then he says something which I think is really interesting and shows you what was going through people's minds at the time before they really knew what AIDS was. He says, but this is only a heter for 1 year. The condom for 1 year. After that year, he has to lavar shuv b'dikot ba'yitrape. He has to undergo more tests. Maybe he'll have been cured. That is, they didn't realize that AIDS is something permanent. Have it, and you're going to have it for the rest of your life. In 1989, when he's writing this, I don't know what the medical community, but the medical community already knew that it would never go away. But maybe rabbis like him, it took a while for the knowledge to reach them. He thinks in 1989 that you have it this year, sort of like an infection. Maybe next year you test yourself, you won't have AIDS anymore. It's all from these AIDS activists and other people, though, that the abstinence activists, that condoms are never absolute and they don't really protect you 100%. So I don't know today whether they would say to have sex with a condom because condoms could break and there could be other problems. I don't know. If someone would ask a Rav today about use of a condom in an AIDS situation, the Rav might say, get divorced. I don't know. It's like a little bit of Russian roulette here, but that's what Rav Mordechai Yahu says. He doesn't quote Rav Chaim Ozer. This is just, he just sees this as obvious that this is halacha. We don't tell people to get divorced. Other than these tshuvot which I've mentioned, I don't think there are any significant tshuvot in the sense that they have had a lasting impact and are constantly quoted. People obviously use the response of Yachiezer, responsa volume. But as with most poskim, the decisions he gives deal with specific cases and don't really have an impact often on future generations. For the great poskim, there are always a number of their rulings that impact, that do have an impact on later generations. I am surprised for Rav Chaim Ozer, it's only these few tshuvot that really are continuously quoted over and over again. I think the reason is that many of the tshuvot of Rav Chaim Ozer deal with Evan Ezer, marriage and divorce law. And they deal with specific cases, agunot, things like that. They don't deal with these groundbreaking issues, such as conversion law or things like that. The sort of laws, sort of tshuvot that you see in Rav Moshe Feinstein and others that are constantly quoted, the Chasam Sofer, they really are specific cases. There are also many tshuvot that deal with theoretical halachic matters or just talmudic investigations. So these are not the sort that will become part of the halachic tradition constantly repeated. He does have a tshuva on abortion where he's more liberal than Rav Moshe Feinstein and Moshe quotes that, but in general, in terms of practical halacha, you don't see him quoted over and over again. I will get to electricity in a minute. The electricity is not really a tshuva. I don't think it's the electricity tshuva per se that's quoted. He does have a letter about electricity. I don't recall a tshuva on it. He has a letter. But there's something else about electricity in Shabbos that is often quoted. But it's not really responsive. I'll get to that. When it comes, however, to leadership in Orthodoxy, I spend 10 classes talking about his influence. All the issues he's in the middle of. But I'm going to speak, and I see we didn't finish this class, we'll finish the next class, about some of the big issues he's in the middle of. We already saw his viewpoint with regard to the separatist community in Jerusalem. For a discussion of his pure halachic side, Rav Zevin's work, Ishim Geshitot, has a good discussion of that. He was also asked about separatism in Germany. He was asked in the early part of the 20th century, is it permitted for Orthodox Jews to remain in one community with the non-Orthodox? This is a dispute that goes back to the 19th century, the famous dispute between Hirsch and Bamberger we've dealt with on numerous occasions. If the Orthodox are not interfered with, if their lifestyle is not interfered with, and their tax dollars does not go to support the Reform institutions, but support the old age home and their shuls, can they still be in one rubric? Hirsch thought no, and Bamberger thought yes, and German Orthodoxy was split over that. So Rav Chaim Moser was asked this question. And Rav Chaim Moser says, this is not a halachic question, and I cannot answer it. He says also that there is a reason why, during the dispute in the mid-19th century between Hirsch and Bamberger, none of them, neither of them turned, or not only neither them, but no one else in Germany, turned to the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. Whenever there were big problems, halachic problems, they turned to Rabbi Zohar Spector, they turned to other Gedolim. But in this matter, they didn't write and ask questions of the rabbis of the East. And Rav Chaim Moser says there's a reason for that, because this is not a halachic issue. It's a question of perspective. That fundamentally, Hirsch and Bamberger are arguing about which approach is best for the Orthodox community. I think it's very interesting what Rafael Moser is saying, because both Bamberger and especially Hirsch would disagree with Rafael Moser here. Hirsch especially thought that this was a halachic matter of the first degree. And yet Rafael Moser says that's really not a halachic matter. That's what he says. He says it's a question of, as I said, perspective. Which approach will be best for the Orthodox community? Those who believe in staying together in one kahila think that they will do more to influence the non-Orthodox this way, kashrus and communal institutions and everything else. And those who believe in separating think that this is the way to secure Orthodoxy. And because it's not a halachic matter, there's no need to turn to people outside of Germany. It has to be the people on the spot. This is printed for the first time in the memorial volume for Reb Chaya Yaakov Weinberg. How could he say that? Read you what he says. He says that this is not solved from sources from the Talmud, Rakal Pi Higayon Yashar, for logic and experience, and only from the basin. It's that's in that place. He says. Is what's going to hurt Orthodoxy? Is it going to hurt Orthodoxy being close to them, or is it going to help them, etc., etc.? He says it's very difficult to solve this problem without getting to the major dispute of Hirsch and Bamberger. And he says this is not a question, kechol horaot iser beheter. And it's not a question like agunot, in which you can find sources in Shas and Poskim. But you need to, and you can't decide based on Kolei Hora'ah. He says that this is based on Hakara Gemura V'Hashkafa Behira. It's based on how you evaluate the situation. And what's the difference between Hirsch and Bamberger? He says they had different Hashkafot. Hashkafoteim, Ayu Shonot, Ko'achal Al Pi Darko B'Kodesh, Shem Shemayim. But again, Hirsch would be the first one to disagree. As a historian, I agree with Rav Chaim Moser. I think it's obvious that Hirsch has a position. He thinks it's wrong for numerous reasons to do with the reformers, and therefore he tries to back it up halachically. But Hirsch would disagree. He would disagree with Rav Chaim Moser and disagree with me. He would, and I'm only speaking subconsciously here. He would say that this is a real halachic issue. I think perhaps Rav Chaim Moser, who didn't read German, never read Hirsch's long correspondence with Bamberger, in which he sets out a strong case permitting, not only obligating separatism. That's the only way I can explain Rav Chaim Moser's position. Another issue that Rav Chaim Moser was asked to deal with was the boycott against Germany. Nazis had taken control in Germany, they had been elected, and immediately world Jewry had begun to speak about a boycott as a way of showing that Jewish blood is not cheap and that the Nazis better not carry through on their proposed agenda, or there will be consequences. Next class, what we will do is we will look at his issue, his role in the boycott, and his dispute with his brother-in-law, Rav Hanan Wasserman. We will also then look at his view of Zionism, an establishment of the State of Israel, and once the State of Israel is going to be established, how to institute Jewish law, or how can a basin operate there? Then we will really come to the end of our dealings with Rav Chaim Moser, and maybe begin already with Rav Elijah Eliyahu ben Amozik. And I will tell you, Shlomo, about the electricity thing. It really has to do with Abdullah, status of electricity. So do we have any questions or comments? We still have at least another half hour, maybe a little more, to deal with Rephaim Ozer Gozinski, which we will do next week. For those who came on late, we'll have two more classes, and we will not go to the fifth. Eighth, let me try. Well, that's the point. He's saying that his Das Torah is irrelevant in Germany because you need to be there. You need to be on the scene, have an understanding of the circumstance, because it's not a question of, it's not a typical Torah matter, it's really a metahalachic, sociological matter. Is it going to be more valuable to the Jewish community, to the Orthodox community in particular, being separate or being together? If you're separate, you can't influence the non-Orthodox, and that has problems with Kirov, and non-Orthodox then could make their institutions on kosher and not follow halacha. Remember, as long as the Orthodox are in one community, the institutions as a whole were kept according to halacha. On the other hand, if you're involved with them, this could influence the Orthodox by reform ideology. So the only way to make such a determination is, as he said, hashkafa behira, you have to have a clear hashkafa, clear outlook, and you have to be on the scene, on the site, to know the metzius. And therefore, he says, that's why he cannot make the decision. He's not there. It's amazing. Today, you'd ask a question to one of the Haredi Gedolim, they very happily give you an answer, even though they're not involved and they don't know the metzius. You tell them, you describe the situation, and they'll paskin, they'll put someone in there, and they'll do all these things. And here, Rephaim Ozer, who knew the situation quite well, wasn't living far away, he knew the history of the issue, and yet he says that I'm not living there, I can't make this decision. And that's also why the Hirsch and Bamberger and the rest of them, they never look towards the East, because this has to be made by the rabbis on the scene. I think it shows a lot about Rechaim Ozer, his sense of modesty and his sense of understanding, although they regarded him as the God, and or the person, that is, who asked him this question, that he can make this decision. Rechaim Ozer wouldn't do it. When it came to Shlita, that's different. Because as long as the Shlita issue only affected Germany, we saw that he was willing to let the German Rabbanim give a decision, and that he would then give his ruling if they wanted it. But only when he saw that it was going to have an impact outside of Germany did he then have to put a stop to it. Discussions. However, something which only affected German Orthodoxy itself said that it's not for me to decide, because it's not a halachic issue. Try telling that to the Aguda today, that it's not a halachic issue. They'll be the first ones to tell you it is a halachic issue. But their God Hadar said it wasn't a halachic issue. We will see next class, we'll go into a little more detail what he says about Israel, though in Palestine, about separatism there. Because as the head of the Aguda, in addition to being recognized as the God Hadar, he had to have a role in this issue, because of Lithuania and Poland going to the land of Israel, they were not used to this separatism. And the Eda Haredit, which was the Aguda, were separatists, so we will see what his perspective was. He was supportive of it. That's what they were so surprised that when they saw his reaction. I don't know if you were here last week. I'll read you what I mentioned last time. I don't need to read it. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, he says, I don't understand why you have such a this feeling of suspicion about the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary and Mayor Hildesheimer and the others. They can't understand why Rephaim Ozer, who's always been so supportive of what's going on in German Orthodoxy, is now has such a suspicious approach to it. And the answer is, as we said, that in Germany, Orthodoxy is the only Orthodoxy that's going to be successful. But we don't want to export this because it's dangerous for elsewhere. Not only is it dangerous, German Orthodoxy is second best. It's when you don't have a choice. You're living in an environment that the only way to keep Jews observant is by a Hirschian approach. Well, that's what you do. However, to try to bring the Hirschian approach to Eastern Europe or to the land of Israel, then that's no good. Rav Goren never actually invalidated a convert for not keeping Torah. But that was what everyone assumed, that he was strongly attacked in the Haredi world for precisely this, the same thing that the Haredi world today is doing. What Rav Goren said was that there was this person, and this was a case in Mamzerus, so it's a much more complicated case, it's a Shas HaTachak. He said that we have this person who claims to have converted, and yet this person is not living an observant life at all. It was evident that the person went to church. And therefore, since the person is not living an observant life, he said that this person is not to be regarded as Jewish. Formally, someone is assumed to be Jewish, and everyone assumes they're Jewish, and says they're Jewish, say they're Jewish. If you walk into shul and say you're Jewish, they don't ask you for records or anything like that. However, in this case, where it was a shas atachak, because there was a case of mamzeris, because the father is Jewish, the kids were mamzerim, got divorced, and she remarried, there he said that, say the person is not Jewish. But he wasn't saying, as the Haredim today are saying, that the person was converted by a beis din, and the fact that now that he's not observant means that it's an invalid conversion from the beginning and can be revoked. Rav Goren said that there was never any evidence that there ever was a conversion. And what's the proof that there's never, even though we normally don't need this sort of evidence, but as I said, if the person is living in the Jewish community and people assume he's Jewish, we regard him as Jewish, unless we know otherwise. But in this case,
there was,
I just was told that I had no sound. So
I lost the context of what I'm holding on to it.
What I said was, I don't know how far back to go. Five minutes? Okay, I lost sound again. I said a lot of important things in the last five minutes. Tell me what the last thing you heard was, and I'll summarize very quickly. We had this problem once also where we lost sound, but I'm holding down on it. Someone can write the last thing he said. I'll summarize it quickly. What I was saying is that exactly what Bill Goldberg said, the issue wasn't pointing of conversion. The issue was that he said that normally, as I said, we assume if someone says they're Jewish and everyone sees they live in a Jewish community, they assume they're Jewish. However, this was a case of Mozarius, this person, if we show that he wasn't really Jewish, then his first wife was married to a Jew, she wasn't an AC, his kids were not Mozarian. This person never lived a Jewish life, but the Pichmai Yisrael, his evidence, he went to church. So Rigorin argued that the fact that he never lived a Jewish life is enough to show that he never was validly, he never was converted. So we're not dealing with today like the Haredim, where they say he was a valid conversion or a based. But the fact that then he stops being observant or was never observant, therefore we can revoke it. We have here the case where the fact that he's not at all observant, and we have no evidence that there ever was a case in, that is enough proof to show that he never was a valid conversion. In fact, he wasn't at all observant to show ever any conversion at all. And from there I discussed how you see that although there were some people who held the traditional world that if you didn't, if you converted and you weren't observant, that it was not a valid conversion. Most rabbis didn't think so. Rav Kook, by the way, has two responses. One, he says, doesn't matter what you think, as long as you go to the motions, the conversion. Well, then the other response, the rabbis say that if you don't really intend to be observant, it's not a valid conversion. He's a great mock conversion. But we have many responsible rabbis saying that you shouldn't convert people who are non-observant. Why shouldn't you convert them? Because then it's putting a mikshel in front of them. We think the behavior, because before they get converted, they didn't have to observe these laws. But after you convert them, Then they're obligated, and Shabbos is conscious, and they're not being officious because we taught them. And since they're not going to be observant, they're committing all the sins, and they're in a worse situation than they were before they converted, where they were obligated. All these rabbis who discussed this, and many of them do, are under the assumption that the conversion is a valid conversion, even though the person isn't observant. And that's why you can't do the conversion, precisely because you're putting the person in a worse situation after than before. But they also said about conversion, if you have the assumption that conversion without observing the mitzvah is not a valid conversion, and then there's not an issue to begin with, because if people are not Jewish, but that's not the argument that many people adopt, and I think it's a great argument. I have a button here, which I press it, cricket, it's supposed to say dark, and I have to sound. So there's no change in the Haredi world when it comes to conversion. I don't know how far to take this. I mean, these people could have eaten on Kippur, who was avoiding their conversion. I think that doesn't mean that.
I also said it's a hard case, a guideline case.
And that Ravad Yosef disagreed with Warren. Ravad Yosef freed one mother than anyone in history, I think. And if he could not find a heter, then that shows you it's a hard case. Unlike the Haredi who said it's an easy case, and Ravad Yosef said it's an easy case, I think you have to agree that it's a hard case both ways. However, Ravad Yosef did accept Gorlim's stock after the fact.
William's summary is 100% correct, everything he says. Very nice.
Is it true? I'm hungry again.
So the legend never heard that before. So I can't say one way or the other. I'm assuming that Refinements would be disappointed at any Tommy Frog who decides to put it in. But that disappointed and angry are two different things.
Thank you, William. I did not know that Rob's wife was his cousin.
Maybe I knew it, but I forgot.
Personalities, all the descriptions of it are very kind, understanding personality to all aspects of the population.
A very modest person, remember what we said, that he refused to protest for his honor.
And Rubenstein was a Hainish rabbi. He didn't want to have any involvement in this. And you get a good sense of his personality from his letters.
Firm when he needs to be. But very kind and solicitous of all segments of the population. He has a number of areas where he disputes with his brother-in-law. Rabbi Hanassim would issue statements about what was going on in the land of Israel.
One of the issues was about using Jewish workers or Arab workers. The Zionists said that you can't use Arab workers, even if they're cheaper, because you have to read. Rabbi Hanan was issuing these placards and other things about what needed to be done in the land of Israel, and Rabbi Hanan, I don't know either why he's doing it. Rabbi Hanan makes sense to him, and that was Rabbi Hanan's personality. Rabbi Hanan saw something that he thought was wrong, he thought it was his duty to put his nose into it, correct people, tell them what they're doing is wrong.
Rabbi Chaim had a very different perspective on it. I am certain that if Rabbi Hanan was asked this question about separatism in Germany, he would have given an answer. Rabbi Chaim, though, was much more hesitant to involve himself. He didn't write letters to people and try to interfere. And even when they asked him, he was very careful. We'll talk about his letters in the first class.
And how he really comes across, unlike Rabbi Hanan, very moderate, very understanding of the state. How he has to, like, the government that he knows that the non-religious is going to run on the state. It's a very realpolitik type of personality, a lot of gravitas, not an accident that he became the sage. And I think he sees clearly in the letters to him.
Feinberg's great criticism of Feinberg's says to him, you're saying all these negative things about the seminary. You think that your role is the head of the body of yeshivas. I mean, basically, you're the rabbi of the lineage of yeshivas, but you're really chief rabbi of all of us.
And he looks to you to defend us against all these Eastern rabbis who attack us. And saying that we have a rabbi factory and we're not serious learners. So we see that he's recognized by the people in Western Europe as being their rabbi also. Something that other Eastern rabbis, who so negative to the whole ethos of Western European Orthodoxy, never would have had this perspective. You heard that the Divine Moser didn't want to give Smicha to the Rav?
Never heard that. But I've never heard of anyone getting Smicha from the Divine Moser. Very, very few. The Divine Moser is not like the Vitzel HaFam. People would go to the Divine Moser to get Smicha. That's not what he did.
There'll be exceptions. Sometimes you would have, I'm sure.
But he didn't do that.
So I don't know if that was ever an option. I don't know why my screen keeps getting bigger. Also, let's not forget the relationship between the emotional relationship and Moses is not such a good one.
Most of them actually wrote letters to the Prime Minister, saying that why don't you publicly explain what my father's position on Amadudo was. So I don't know if he ever asked him. However, Rav Shapiro was a much more moderate, but ideologically, the Kovno Rav was not a Buddhist. On the contrary, he was even an anti-Buddhist.
So it's only natural that the Rav would go to Kovno. Now there's no video or audio of Prime Moses's. We have plenty of pictures, but no video or no audio. Okay, well, everyone, one more question. Okay, make this the last question, which has nothing to do with what you did say. Was he a rationalist or a Maimonidean, or was he a mystic? Remember those old commercials, light beer from Miller, where they would say, I feel strongly both ways, taste, calories. If you went to Professor Twersky's, he wasn't Professor Twersky, Rabbi Twersky, on Shabbos, and he was wearing his long kippah. If you went on the Gemula of his father or other people in the Chernobyl dynasty, you would see a Chassidish Rebbe. On the other hand, if you were with him, as I was, during the week, you would see a rationalist and a Maimonidean. And a brisker. So which was he? My only answer is, I think it depends what day you came. But if you want to know deep down what you were, His whole life was lived as a rationalist, as a Maimonidean. He followed the show from his father, when his father passed away, and sort of came into that role. So he lived as a professor's holy, and yet on his deathbed, he did say that he had to do it again, he'd be a Rosh Yeshiva. But he did, no question, I testify to them from conversations with them and being with them. Every day almost, for a few years, including in his house, at least the Twersky I knew was very much a rationalist and very much a Maimonidean. How this works with being a Chassidish Rebbe on Shabbos, I don't know. I only knew him as a student close up for about five years. Obviously his sons would have a different perspective. And yet Mayor Twersky knew him as a father, knew him in the Vinnick mode, Mayor Twersky wasn't in his classes at Harvard. So it's a very complicated person. And what makes it more complicated is that Professor Twersky would have been a leader of Orthodoxy in America, Rav's son-in-law, such a mind. He was basically unknown outside the Western community. When I was saying, tell people when I'm studying under Professor Twersky, they would say they wouldn't confuse him with Abraham Twersky. They wouldn't know who he was. He was very content to remain in his Dalai Lama's, and I know he could have been the great scholar, president, and all these other shows. He could have been articles like Lichtenstein, putting forth a vision of Torah Ramada, because that's what he believed. Fundamentally, he believed Torah Ramada. He wrote that one article on Rav. That's all the eulogies on Rav, and he was very content to see in the medieval times. And maybe it's insightful. Someone mentioned to me that maybe the reason Twersky spent all his time in the medieval period is because he actually found the medieval period more open-minded and more appealing than the modern period. People like Ibn Kasi and Foley and all these medieval rationalists that he wrote about, the Rambam, that he was very attracted to. And the contemporary Orthodox world is full of extremists and controversies. So it was suggested, maybe correctly, that he saw the medieval world as a time where he could be among peers. And who would his peers be? And from that, who was his peer? Rambam actually got Shiva at Twersky's house. Yeah. Okay, good night, everyone. If you want to hear more about President Whiskey, I can do it in the future class. But we're a little late now. William typing.
Okay, so remind me, I can speak a little more. I only knew him as a student, as I refused to go to the shul because of the very point that someone brings up. I found it very hard on one hand, say on Monday, to talk to him about whether Rambam believed, let's say, the Nesach Hashem, and ask him that question. And then on Shabbos, to see him in a different mode, even though I will tell you, his Rashi's, and spoke at Shalosh, what's he got to see Rebbe, still seeking the same intellectual type, but to see him in rabbinic mode, for me was difficult because I'm related very differently during the week, seeing him as a Hasidic Rebbe, he was in a sense a Rashi's Hasidic Rebbe, full Hasidic scoring, but he would call him to make Rashi's type point. He wasn't quoting mirrors very many times like that, but still just to see him functioning as a Hasidic Rebbe, when I related to him very differently during the week, I didn't know what to call him, because I called professors or something, my sister's call him. Shabbos, I went one year for San Francisco, I went to a few times, I lived literally like four blocks, and I would go to his house, I was a research assistant, and I would go to his house to, I was with him often, in fact my friend David Zinberg, who was a student with me at the time, some of my friend, he then dropped out of the program, he might have said that Twersky was in the Rebbe was still alive. Although the Rebbe wasn't all there, but he went to Twersky's professor later one night. And I'm sure had I gone to the shul and become close to him that way, I would have given entree into the next side of him. But besides, I don't know. He got annoyed with me. He told me that I had chipped my shul, he conceded him. Said that I was such a snob, it really bothered him. And I don't think that's true at all. I don't think I have chipped my shul. He thought that I was prejudiced in favor of the Vilna Gaon against the Hasidim, and only half jokingly, I'm not sure, maybe he really was offended, but I mean, he smiled when he said that, but I don't know if I'm a poor person thinking into his, into his Passover Seder, because as I said, he didn't think that I had such sympathy for the Hasidim. Okay, good night, everyone. Pick it up next week.